So tonight, I'd like to start this Dharma talk with a koan. And the koans, as you know, are part of the Zen tradition, and they are stories that often can seem a little opaque when we first encounter them, but they're really stories about what it means to be human, whether it's in ancient China or Japan or here. So this koan was actually inspired by something that Maddie said in our Dharma dialogue last week, and I'll get to that. It's the third case of the Blue Cliff Record. And the case is Master Ma is unwell. Great Master Ma was unwell. The temple superintendent asked him, "Teacher, how has your venerable health been in recent days?" The great master said, "Sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha." So, if this is not immediately clear, Master Ma was one of the great Zen teachers, and he was the leader of a monastery. And he was not just unwell in this koan, but many writers say that he was on his deathbed. So this was a serious question. In ancient tradition, the sun-faced Buddha was a form of the Buddha who was vigorous and strong and lived for 1,800 years. And the moon-faced Buddha was small and slight and existed only for a day and a night. So the attendant asks Master Ma, "How are you?" basically, knowing that he was gravely ill. And Master Ma says, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." And I took this from Maddie's comment last week about our mental lives being in some ways like the weather, that there are sunny days and cloudy days. And here was Master Ma dying, but saying, "You know, sometimes I feel like the strongest guy in the world who's going to live for 1,800 years, and the sun is out and everything is good. And sometimes I feel like it's almost all over." And what I want to talk about is what this points to, which, more than pointing to the urgency of life and death, which we talk about a lot in Zen, points to something that pervades everything in our practice, which is that truth of impermanence, the truth that everything in the universe is changing, is constantly changing. Everything is arising and falling away in each moment. That truth is the core of all of the teachings. It's one of the Four Noble Truths. And some Zen teachers say that the Buddha way is simply living out the truth of impermanence. Everything flows from it and leads back to it. In fact, we're reciting things that remind us of this all the time. We recite the five remembrances. I remember being struck by that when I first came to this Sangha, now many years ago. I'm of the nature to grow old. I'm of the nature to have ill health. I'm of the nature to die. All that is dear to me and everything I love is of the nature of change. And I would sit there and read that and say, yeah, I've really got to remember this. Even though it's something we all know, we know it from the time we're very young, But the mind is constantly saying, no, this cannot be. And so at the deepest level, we are constantly trying to convince ourselves that impermanence is not real, at least in some corners of our lives. And yet it's everywhere. Last night, I get the Sunday night blues. I start thinking about the week to come, and I think, oh no, I just can't manage it all. And last night, there I was, sitting there thinking about my Monday morning. Why did I have this meeting? And this was going to be a really difficult discussion, and why was I doing that? And then, oh no, I'm going to give a Dharma talk tomorrow night. And I was working myself into a little bit of a funk. Actually, a lot of a funk. And I decided that my life was badly arranged and I really had to make major changes and that I really didn't know how to conduct my work life in a sane way. And I took a deep breath and had this image of myself as this cranky toddler having a tantrum. And so, as the parent of a cranky toddler, I put myself to bed. I woke up this morning. Sun-faced Buddha. Things were fine. Things were, you know, that meeting wasn't going to be so bad. And actually, I was kind of looking forward to giving the Dharma talk tonight. And, you know, really, actually, I like my work and it's manageable. And absolutely nothing had changed. Yeah, I'd had some sleep. Okay. But nothing, really. The circumstances of my life had not changed. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. With us all the time if we're willing to observe it. Why aren't we willing to observe it? Why do we keep trying to fool ourselves into saying, no, this I can hold on to, this I can make stay, this I can get rid of and keep away? I think it has to do with what brings us to this practice, which is suffering. We all come to this practice because in some way or other, life is not satisfactory. We wouldn't do this. We wouldn't spend all this time on the cushion and in these practices if everything were wonderful in the rest of our lives. And of course, it isn't wonderful for anybody else either. But we're saying, I want to face this. But of course, we come to this practice wanting to fix something. Maybe many things, but at least one thing. I want to be less angry or judgmental. I want to be less afraid. I want to be happier. I want to be less alone. So many things that we want and that we want to fix. And the problem with fixing is that it's got two completely intertwined meanings in our language that are really relevant here. One is remedy. But the way we try to remedy is by fixing in the other sense of the word, by freezing, by hardening, by forcing. I want this to go away, and I want this to be in my life and never to leave. It is absolutely part of our human condition. If you have a heart and a mind and you're in the world, of course you want this. And it is what draws us to this practice. And so we don't want to see the truth of impermanence. I mean, it's fine that I could, yes, I'm glad that my cranky toddler mood last night was impermanent. And this morning I woke up as sun-faced Buddha. That was good. But I don't want to see that all that's dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of change, and that there's no way to avoid being separated from them. I don't want to see that. I don't want to see that this crankiness is it. It's part of my life. It's part of the universe universing through me. Not to be pushed away. Can't be pushed away. And so I spend a lot of time trying to negate the truth of impermanence. And that's why we practice. Because we sit down and we see that cranky toddler mode is present and then it subsides. We see that the fears that we think we cannot stay with on the cushion somehow ebb away without our making anything happen. We also see that those wonderful, blissful times on the cushion ebb away without our making anything happen. In fact, one of the reasons why we urge people to have longer periods of practice is not because there's some great endurance thing that we want and other people to go through at all, in fact, but simply that during those longer days of practice or those retreats, those sesshins, we pare everything down. So actually very little happens in the world, in that little world. Everything is tightly controlled. And what you get to watch is sun-faced Buddha appearing and then moon-faced Buddha appearing. Or as Maddie said last week, the clouds coming, the clouds going, like weather patterns. And what happens is a kind of recognition, a kind of knowing in our bones that is not cognitive, but that we know at the deepest level. We know that what arises will pass away because we experience it over and over again. And so we hold what arises more lightly. I didn't quit my job last night. I didn't call up my boss and say, I'm out of here. And boy, did I feel like it. But there's a way in which practice allows just a bit more spaciousness around those things that we most don't want to be here. And of course, that's why we keep saying to each other, yes, and this is it too. This is really it. This thing that I most don't want to be here, this is also it. And it's not going to stay. So the technology for this deep knowing of impermanence is what we do here. And there are many, many ways to know it. In every moment, we can know it, the arising and the falling away, watching the clouds, driving to work. This is just a concentrated form that allows us to know it a little more vividly. And what we get to is what Alan so brilliantly chose. I didn't tell him, I said I didn't need any special reading, but he chose a reading that's just perfect. Unless you accept your present circumstances, happiness cannot be attained. To face any situation and accept it with open arms molds the attitude, enabling you to see that a wonderful way of living is possible. This is indeed something of consequence. As soon as this attitude is achieved, you have reached paradise anytime, anywhere, and in any circumstance. It's the path that isn't a path. It's the paradox that when we finally let go of the insistence on fixing things, things get fixed. Not frozen, but remedied just a little bit. And the one thing that we can always rely on, the only permanent thing in the universe, is this magnificent impermanence. Thank you. So now we have time for a Dharma dialogue. Please sit comfortably and thoughts, complaints, questions.
I could a little you made a side comment that was perked my interest, so I'm just asking for a little bit of explanation. And that was this idea of impermanence is one of the three noble truths. And which one? Is it the Buddha or the Dharma, or have I missed it totally?
It's that light, that all impermanent dharmas are unsatisfactory. So that essentially suffering arises from the truth of from the fact of impermanence.
Thank you.
And life is suffering. Life is, well, suffering is one word that's used for it, but also life is unsatisfying.
I understand. Thank you.
Yeah.
I was struck when you were talking about the five remembrances especially, but also the koan, that, you know, we're living in a culture that constantly is telling us, don't be a moon-faced Buddha,
right,
when you could be a
moon-faced
Buddha. Exactly. You know, and people are making so many fortunes selling us, you know, bogus anti-aging creams, and, you know, and people are pursuing all these ways to stave off death.
Yeah.
And fantasizing about genetic, you know, medicine that will, maybe we won't have to die, and just, you know, and on it, and you know, and rightly maybe, but maybe it doesn't have to be so obsessive. You know, we build up our retirement funds so that we don't have to be parted from all those things we love quite so quickly as we might, you know.
Absolutely.
Maybe we can hang on to them a few more years before we're eating dog food and living in a hovel. So, you know, so it's really interesting the way that spring. I don't know why I chose it, except I kind of liked it. But it's funny how that spring everywhere just cuts through all that and says, you know, that expensive anti-aging eye cream isn't really what you need. What you need is to say, if my eyes are getting baggy, they can get baggy.
Exactly.
If I'm dying a little younger than my dad did, I'll just die. So it's pretty powerful stuff.
Very powerful. There was a, I used to work next to an office called Center on the Media, and this is totally not Zen. And they would have these great ads, and one was of this great, you know, really buff guy, this Calvin Klein model, holding out his underpants and looking down. You can't see anything. You're just looking at the underpants. And the caption is, "For every doubt, there is a product." And what I hear in your, you know, in what you said is that, and what I see a lot now when I watch commercials is basically the reflection of this yearning that the advertising industry knows how to tap into, but this yearning for safety, for pleasure, to avoid pain, all of that, and they're saying, just do this and you can avoid it. Just do this and you'll be safe. And it is how we're built. That is our yearning. Maddie.
So the spring everywhere resonates for me, but it also, there's some parts that I would, if I had written it, I would use different words, maybe, like, because sometimes even Zen texts can fall into that, some preference for sun-faced Buddha. And so the word happiness stands out. The sentence, "Unless you accept your present circumstances, happiness cannot be attained," as if that's the thing. I would maybe use the word aliveness to include sadness, to include great pain. And the talk was very, very helpful to my students, because I'm struggling with the impermanence, particularly the everyone I love, even though I tried so hard, you know, to like recognize along the way that this particular very close intimate relationship was impermanent, we still thought that it wouldn't be on some level. And I guess I kind of have a question about that, which is, if like, well, maybe tomorrow something crazy will happen that will change the nature of our relationship. You can't just kind of be always expecting that. But then when it happens, it just, if you build up that trust based on a sort of not necessarily expecting it to always work out, but if you build that up and then it just kind of starts falling apart, that's really, really hard.
You've said so many important things. I don't know where to begin, but...
So the question is, what do I do?
So what do you do? Well... First of all, I totally agree about that word happiness. I think aliveness is much more what we're after, but also what is available to us. Happiness is not always available. And but I really like what you say, because you know we do want happily ever after in our relationships, right? We really do. And I mean but I think in some ways, it's almost the way we think about the precepts. It's like what we really do is we aspire to certain commitments in relationships. We formulate an intention to have something that will endure for a long time with somebody, will endure through hard times, and that we can't predict. But that's our intention and that's our aspiration, and that's probably more realistically what we could promise each other. I don't know. Really.
I wanted to add a little something to that, yeah. which is that, you know, even if, and this, you know, I almost shouldn't say this, but Natty, you're quite young, and even if, you know, after years and years and years, you and however many commitments, you find the commitment that really lasts, and it can happen, you know, it might take decades, it might not, but you and the person that you're committed to are still subject to sickness and death, right. You know, so there's no commitment that's free of this uncertainty and impermanence that Bob started out by talking about, and, you know, and a lot of, you know, romantic movies are made about this. You know, you find the right person, and then 2 days later they get diagnosed with cancer, and it's inoperable, and you've got a year. We've all seen that movie, right? Probably too many times. But there's some truth to that, and the truth is, you know, not that, wow, well, that's really cool with magic, but yeah, you know, it doesn't matter. The impermanence is built into being human, and so it's kind of like getting on a roller coaster ride and just, you know, with no safety belt, and just, you know, going for having a really great time, and you know, having that intensity you were talking about, but it's not going to slow down for us.
Thank you, Bob. I too have been struck by the five remembrances when I began coming here. I had read them before, but actually it is a different thing to repeat them every night or every day, as in fact I do. And sometimes I actually hear myself saying them, and my response is, do you really want to remember this?
Yeah.
You know, it makes me aware of the kind of dyad that Zen sets up, because there are things that I do in order, hopefully, to awaken. And there are things that I do in order to forget or to go to sleep. And quite frequently, I am attempting to forget these five remembrances in the things that I'm doing. But you also pointed out what I think is, to me, an appealing reason to practice, which is, how did you put it, to live out the truth of impermanence. And it's just as you say, the practice teaches us that on a very profound level, everything is impermanent. And so the choice is to, you know, pursue the fantasy of eternal youth, or to align oneself with the reality of the situation, which is impermanent, which is impermanence. And for some reason that appeals to me. know, at least I'm not living a lie. Maybe a painful truth, but it ain't a lie. In regard to Spring Everywhere, I like Maddie's revision of it. I think happiness, you know, reminds me of the pursuit of happiness, the pursuit of our consumer bliss. And I think happiness or equanimity is a better word. But it also reminds me that what the Buddha said to simplify his teaching was, I teach the alleviation of suffering and nothing else. And that's what Spring Everywhere is alluding to, that there is a state, there is an attitude which we can touch in which, you know, it doesn't matter whether I feel good or whether I feel bad, whether it's sun-faced or whether it's moon-faced. So thank you.
Yes.
For that reminder.
And one thing I want to add to that is that I used to imagine that that was a state that you could get to and stay in. And what this practice begins to show us is that nobody gets there and stays there. That you can touch it, you can move in and out of it, but there is no place to land. And that's the bait and switch of this practice. Yes?
I was just thinking of something that Melissa said during the coming and going session. We were working with some text. I don't even remember what.
Can everybody hear?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm talking into my... Let me talk more loudly. We were... Melissa was talking during the coming and going session about some text, and we kept retranslating it every time somebody would read it because nobody could come up with words. And it was very much around this, is it happiness? Is it aliveness? Aliveness was something everybody liked. And I don't remember who said it. Maybe it was even me, or maybe it was Melissa, I don't know. But somebody brought it back to the concept of wholeness. Mm. Because wholeness also includes deadness. It's not only aliveness,
yeah,
right? It's not only the things that we like or feel energized by. And that seemed important because there was a lot of talk about what you were referring to earlier on, of people coming to Zen often with some subtext, at least, of I'm going to fix this, I'm going to change that. And that, in essence, that's cutting something off, and you can't have wholeness if the goal, if your secret goal is to remove some piece of it, even if it's a horrible piece. So in some ways that was helpful, clarifying to me.
Yeah, that everything is it. There aren't two categories.
Not even equanimity. Equanimity is another state, but it's not really a resting place. At least not the way our folks talk about Zen. Maybe some Zen reaches that, but not the boundless way.
So the five remembrances were, when I remember back to the first time I sat with vows, which was the first time I ever sat Zen at all, that was the only thing that I felt immediately connected to, because it was just like, okay, I don't understand the Japanese here at all, or what Buddha means, but oh, death, yeah, there it is, like, and as I've now I guess been saying that fairly regularly for a few years, I'm starting to sort of notice how the five remembrances can be listened to or heard in different ways. So, like the whole two sides of the same coin thing. If I'm of the nature to lose everyone I love, I'm also of the nature to be intimate with that loss, to be intimate enough with these people or to feel the depth of that. So then the five remembrances can be